once again. It's been a couple weeks since we've been in our Genesis passage. So we're at chapter 42, Genesis 42 today, and we're going through four chapters, if we can. But just by way of review, just to bring us up to speed for those of us that may have forgotten or weren't with us in the past few weeks, it's the story of Joseph. It's a fantastic story. I think most of us are familiar with it, at least kind of the general flow of the story, how things go with Joseph, the son of Jacob, the son of Isaac, the son of Abraham. God is working through these people, the patriarchs. We're at Joseph, and there's been some sort of competition between him and his brothers, I suppose you could say. It's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then who's the next? Joseph didn't get treated very well by his brothers. Maybe he got treated a little too well by his father. And anyway, if you were here a couple weeks ago, Frank would have taken us to how Joseph kind of rose to be basically second only to Pharaoh over the whole country of Egypt. What would that have been like? Egypt was a pretty strong and influential country. You try and think of the equivalent today, would that be like the United States? We don't, and they don't have sort of kings or pharaohs in most of the, at least Western democracies, shall we say. Who would Joseph have been? You think you have a king, you have a pharaoh, and then you have the guy under the king or pharaoh that kind of gets things done. And that's what Joseph was. He was the guy, maybe kind of like a grand vizier kind of thing. A lot of times it's an evil grand vizier in some of the stories. But he's not the king or the sultan or the pharaoh. He's the guy just under him that's kind of seeing and making sure things happen that are supposed to happen. So Joseph was in this position, and his family wouldn't have known anything about it. It's been 20, 22 maybe years since his brothers sold him. And that's the last time, back in 37, his brothers sold him into slavery, and he's gone. Who knows if he's even alive from their point of view. So we're going to look at these four chapters. I'm going to try not to have to read through the whole thing. There's a little bit of repetition, but we should look at it for some of the things, speaking for myself, I might not have been aware of before I looked a little closer. Things, little subtle things about certain brothers like Reuben, Judah, Simeon. So there's famine, not just in Egypt, but in Canaan as well. Genesis 42, when Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other?" He continued, "I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." You wonder, okay, Jacob heard that there is grain in Egypt, and why would that have been in their mind? Was it a miraculous event? Or is, well, Egypt is just, Egypt's got their act together. They got grain. They got a really fertile Nile Valley or whatever delta that they don't really have the famine like everywhere else. They weren't aware, probably, that there was a miraculous intervention that Joseph played a part in, that's now they have grain. Wow. And if Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, do you think Joseph heard that there was famine in Canaan? And I wonder if Joseph is expecting to see any Canaanites show up to get some grain. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die. That idea, that little phrase comes up a few times, actually, not just in these chapters, but in more chapters. It actually comes up not just in the book of Genesis, but throughout the first five books of the Bible. The idea of you have a choice between death and life, to choose life, living and dying. Anyway, you can get into that on your own time for the most part. I want to point that out because it comes up in our passage. 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt, but Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to him. And as sort of the theme is kind of reasserting itself, you got the favorite wife, remember, of Jacob, because he had two wives plus some sub-wives or concubines or whatever you want to call them. His favorite wife was Rachel, and she didn't have any sons until finally Joseph came along after a whole bunch of other brothers, and then Benjamin. So two sons from the favorite wife. Joseph got shown favoritism, and that didn't end up going very well for Joseph, at least in the short term. And now Joseph's gone, but years later, there's Benjamin. He's the other son of the favorite wife, and he's still favored by Jacob. It's almost like, has Jacob learned that favoritism isn't a good idea? Maybe not. What else is going on? So, you brothers, you go to Egypt. Benjamin, you can stay here. He didn't want any harm to come to him. Did he have just a little clue that his other sons might have something to do with Joseph's disappearance? I mean, the last we hear, he says, oh, I guess there's blood on this robe. I guess some animal must have eaten or killed him. But you wonder if he kind of thought, well, maybe there's something else going on. We don't know. But he's pretty protective of Benjamin. He sent Joseph to the brothers, and that didn't go so well. So he's not sending Benjamin with the other brothers. You almost can wonder, he's kind of a little suspicious, maybe, but Israel's sons, the name Jacob and the name Israel, are starting to kind of be both used almost in equal proportion at this time. His new name, Israel. Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Joseph was the governor of the land, the one who sold grain to all its people. That would be a big job if you got a whole bunch of people coming to buy grain from the only place in a very large area that had grain. So he wasn't just kind of sitting around eating grapes. He was pretty busy looking after who's coming and going and getting grain. So if anybody was going to see who's coming to get grain, it was Joseph. So he was ready to see who shows up, and they showed up. And would you believe it? They bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. Just like he dreamed that that would happen. Came true. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. And we can ask why he was being harsh, whether this is my time now for some payback, because the tables have turned and now it's my turn. Is it revenge or was it something else? Was there some other reason for him to be harsh? Could it have gone the other way? Could he have said, oh, it's my brothers. Hey, guys, it's me, Joseph. Hey, how are you doing? Why don't you guys... It could have gone another way, right? If he was just real happy to see his brothers. Why don't you guys come on over to my place? Because I'm the big shooter here now. And you come to my place, and I'll make sure you guys are okay. You don't even have to worry about grain. I got all kinds of things in my house. You don't worry about it. You guys come over here. You can actually leave the old man back in Canaan and your spoiled brother. Don't worry about him either. You guys just come. This is, we're all happy. He wasn't all happy. And even though it says, in a sense, he forgot some of his sorrow in his time in Egypt, he named his firstborn, Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh, chapter 41, verse 51. It is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. I can imagine if I was in that position, I'd want to forget. There weren't very many happy memories. I mean, we know that when Joseph was 17, that's when the events of chapter 37, but who knows how many years even before that, his brothers didn't treat him too well. He doesn't have very many happy memories about his family, but here he is. His brothers show up. What's he going to do? Well, he speaks harshly, and Joseph recognized him. He says he remembered his dreams. Why does it say in verse 9 he remembered his dreams about them? We got We got 10 brothers bowing down. In his dreams, it was 11. So maybe he's thinking, we're 10 for 11 here. In my dream, we're missing one. So for it to be fulfilled, I need one more brother to show up and bow. So I'm going to make that happen. And how does he make that happen? He doesn't let them know who he is. He brings a little stress. He pushes them a bit. He said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected." "No, my lord," they answered. "Your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies." "No," he said to them, "you have come to see where our land is unprotected." But they replied, "Your servants were 12 brothers, the sons of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no more." So he's pushing them, and now they're telling him the story. They're telling Joseph what's going on. So he's giving them a little stress, and that's pushing them to tell, at least now they're telling the truth, and they're telling them about Benjamin. Joseph said to them, "It is just as I told you. You are spies, and this is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of your number to get your brother. The rest of you will be kept in prison, so that your words may be tested to see if you are telling the truth. If you are not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." And he put them all in custody for 3 days. So he's turning the screws down on them, put them in jail, and we still don't know, just reading through, whether it's just him getting revenge on his brothers or whether there's something else going on. But now he's telling them, "You got to bring your brother." And he starts off pretty harsh. But on the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God." And so now there's a hint to the brothers that maybe Joseph isn't just an unreasonable, evil grand vizier. But he says, "If you are honest men, let one of your brothers stay here in prison while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die." This they proceeded to do. So it used to be, you guys are all in prison except for one to go back and get your brothers. Now it softens a little bit. We're going to keep one in prison and the rest of you can go home and get your brother. And so it softened a little bit. And he also makes reference to God, "I fear God." Now, whether it's just Joseph kind of changing his strategy, changing his mind, or whether this was sort of a deliberate plan, it's hard to know. But it softens a little bit. So the brothers say, "Okay, this is here's where things start to come out into the open. Things start to be revealed." And it turns out Joseph wanted to know what his brothers were thinking, where their hearts were at. And so the brothers said to one another, "Surely we are being punished because of our brother." Interesting that they would come to that conclusion. That sort of guilt has been hanging over their heads for 22 years. That they got rid of their brother, sold him. It's almost equivalent to killing him. They got rid of him, and they thought probably they got away with it. And it's sort of been hanging over their heads. A little bit maybe like us, not in terms of being murderers and slave traders, but a conscience of something that we've done that's wrong and we know it. We may have gotten away with it, but it sort of hangs over us, niggles. We know it's not right. "Surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come upon us. What goes around comes around, whether you like it or not. It seems you get away with it, but no." And they're saying this to each other, and Joseph is listening. And they don't know that he's listening and understanding because they don't think he speaks Hebrew. And then Reuben pipes up. Interesting, it singles out Reuben. And we start to learn a little bit about Reuben as we go along these chapters. He's misbehaved, but he's sort of made some attempt in chapter 37. He made some attempt to save his brother Joseph, but it didn't really work out. It's kind of weird. He made some attempt, but it didn't work out. And now he's piping up again. Is he the first guy to speak because he's the oldest and he feels the responsibility to kind of step up because he's the oldest? Or is it more just his personality that that's more how he is? Anyway, Reuben says, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood. And so, didn't I tell you I was right and you guys were wrong?" I like how the NAS, New American Standard, puts that. Instead of saying, "Now we must give an accounting for his blood," it says in the NAS, "Now comes the reckoning. Now comes the reckoning. And now we pay. Now we're going to pay for what we did." And it's like, wow. This comes to them in the middle of nowhere, but they see, here we are now. Now we're in trouble. And it's not because of anything having to do with a famine or grain or traveling. It's because we sold our brother. Their conscience, their guilt. It's a human thing because we're supposed to have a conscience. We're supposed to realize when we do something wrong and that there's consequences. And Joseph is listening. They did not realize that Joseph could understand them since he was using an interpreter. He turned away from them and began to weep, but then turned back and spoke to them again. Okay, now a little more info. Joseph is weeping. Now, we know where Joseph's heart is, and we know that Joseph has a soft heart. Because if he had a hard heart, what would his reaction be when his brothers come? "He's the grand vizier, and I am going to pay you guys back good." He wouldn't be sad, he'd be happy. He'd say, "Yes, we're going to rectify certain iniquities now that I am in a position to do so." He'd be happy. He would be, "Yes," smiling. But he's not happy because he's identifying with his brothers. He has a soft heart. It's not revenge he's thinking about. He's thinking about reconciliation, but he wants to know where his brothers' hearts are at. And he knows that there's going to be a process of reconciliation. You can't just, "Oh, come on, everything's good, we're all happy." There has to be some responsibility. There has to be some acknowledgement of what's going on. The relationship has to be restored by a certain process. And this is the process that Joseph is taking his brothers through. So instead of you all getting to be in jail, it's just Simeon. And why Simeon? Well, from some other stories we've gone through, Simeon's not a good guy. Him and at least one of his brothers have misbehaved. Reuben disqualified himself in a way, but at least he tried back in 37, chapter 37, in kind of a feeble attempt to save Joseph. Who's next in line? Reuben? Simeon. Simeon's next. We don't see him trying to do anything good for Joseph. Levi, and then Judah is next. Judah, well, he was part of the, he was kind of the, "Let's sell our brother" idea. At least they saved his life, and it turned out, oh, he survived and actually thrived. So is that bad or is it good? Well, he saved his brother's life. So Judah kind of is next in line in terms of credibility. Reuben tries. Reuben speaks up. Simeon's next in line. "You're responsible. Simeon's the guy. You get to stay in jail. Everybody else gets to go." Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to put each man's silver back in his sack, and to give them provisions for their journey. After this was done for them, they loaded their grain on their donkeys, left at the place where they stopped for the night. One of them opened his sack to get feed for the donkey and saw his silver in the mouth of his sack. "My silver has been returned," he said to his brothers. "Here it is. In my sack." Their hearts sank, and they turned to each other, trembling, and said, "What is this that God has done to us?" And now, for the first time reading through these chapters, these brothers mention God. You don't really see any mention of God from these brothers. And so it's like their awareness, or at least what's coming out of their mouth, is progressing. They know they did something wrong. They know there's consequences, and they believe that God is involved. And they're right. God is involved. What is this that God has done to us? Their conscience, punishment, guilt for sin. They're coming along. It's kind of like you need to acknowledge something if you're in the wrong before you can take the steps of reconciliation. This is their acknowledgement. This is their acknowledgement of their guilt and that God punishes sin. When they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened. And so you have them telling Jacob what happened. So we don't need to necessarily read through that whole thing. And Jacob's brought up to speed about what happened. Their father Jacob, in verse 36, said to them, "You have deprived me of my children." So he doesn't necessarily believe the story about the animal killing Joseph, maybe, when he says, or at least there's the hint, "You have deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more." It's not exactly true. Neither is that about Joseph. "And now you want to take Benjamin. Everything is against me." It almost seems Jacob's kind of a pitiful character when he's everything's against me. The whole world's against me. It seems to kind of, everything revolves around Jacob in a way. It's kind of like it's all about him. It's my, what are you guys doing to me? And we hope that Jacob can kind of progress from that as well. Once again, verse 37, who pipes up first? Reuben. And he says, "You may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Entrust him to my care and I will bring him back. If I don't bring him back, you can kill my sons." Is that realistic? Jacob, okay, yes, I'll kill your sons, my grandsons, if you don't come back here with Benjamin. That's a great idea. So once again, Reuben sort of pipes up first and he makes some attempt, but he doesn't really have the credibility. Jacob sort of brushes it off. "My son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead and he is the only one left." Well, the only one of the sons of my favorite wife. "If harm comes to him on the journey you are taking, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow." Anyway, Reuben's pitch doesn't really work. And so we're going to put it off for a while. Now the famine was still severe. So when they had eaten all the grain they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, "Go back and buy us a little more food." And now Judah gets the turn to explain, kind of like, well, we're not just kind of going back there and getting more grain. There's certain conditions. Judah said to him, "The man warned us solemnly, you will not see my face again unless your brother is with you. If you will send our brother along with us, we will go down and buy food for you. But if you will not send him, we will not go down, because the man said to us, you will not see my face again unless your brother is with you." And Jacob, or Israel, is kind of between a rock and a hard place here. He's really getting pushed. He says, "Why did you bring this trouble on me by telling the man you had another brother? Why did you have to tell him?" "Does it matter now?" They replied, "The man questioned us closely about ourselves and our family. We simply answered his questions. How are we to know he would say, bring your brother down here?" Okay, the brother speaking, and then Judah speaks again, singles out Judah again, says, "Judah said to Israel his father, send the boy along with me, and we will go at once, so that we and you and our children may live and not die." That phrase comes up again. So that phrase, "so that we may live and not die," comes, it's almost like he's quoting his dad when his dad told him to go down in chapter 42, verse 2, "go down, buy some for us so that we may live and not die." So Judah is sort of quoting Jacob when he says, we got to go back down so that we may live and not die. Judah says, "I myself will guarantee his safety. You can hold me personally responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him here before you, I will bear the blame before you all my life. As it is, if we had not delayed, we could have gone and returned twice." And so it's his turn to try and push his dad. Would it have been possible for the brothers to just grab Benjamin and go without his dad's permission? probably could have. But Judah respects his father and says, let us go and take Benjamin. And so this time it works. And their father Israel said to them, if it must be, then do this. Put some of the best products of the land in your bags and take them down to the man as a gift. Balm, honey, spices. Take double the amount of silver with you, for you must return the silver that was put back into the mouths of your sacks. Perhaps it was a mistake. Take your brother also and go back to the man at once. And may God Almighty grant you mercy before the man so that he will let your other brother and Benjamin come back with you. As for me, if I am bereaved, I am bereaved. And so Jacob finally kind of acts the way he should. He sort of, it's almost like he's praying for the brothers. He's involving God in it. And that's kind of doing more what he should be doing. May God Almighty grant you mercy before the man. And so they get to go. Joseph saw Benjamin with them. He said to his steward, take these men to my house, slaughter an animal, and prepare dinner. They are to eat with me at noon. The man did as Joseph told him, took the men to Joseph's house. The men were frightened when they were taken to his house. It's a little weird. You got the grand vizier. He was against us, telling us we were spies. And now he's bringing us to his house. What's going on? And it's probably a pretty big house, and he's probably got a dungeon under there. What's going on here? They start thinking, that makes no sense. What's he going to do with us? He wants to attack us and overpower us and seize us as slaves and take our donkeys. Because the grand vizier, the number two man in the whole country of Egypt, there's nothing that's going to satisfy him more than a couple or three Canaanite donkeys. But that's what they're thinking because they can't make sense of it. What is going on here? So they went up to Joseph's steward. And of course the steward's in on it, at least a little bit. Interesting. Spoke to the steward. Please, sir, we came down here the first time to buy food, but at the place where we stopped for the night, we opened our sacks and each of us found his silver, the exact weight, in the mouth of his sack. So we have brought it back with us. We have also brought additional silver with us to buy food. We don't know who put our silver in our sacks. And so they're appealing to the steward, and they're at least telling him the truth. They're not making up stories or some weird excuses. They're telling him the truth, and they're just laying it, this is what happened, and we don't know why. We've brought it back. The brothers are basically doing everything they can right now. Let's do it right this time. We're going to do it right. They're trying. And the steward, it's all right, he said. Don't be afraid. Your God, the God of your father, has given you treasure in your sacks. I guess it's true in a roundabout way. I received your silver. Then he brought Simeon. You could translate, I kind of looked it up. He says, the steward says, it's all right. That's sort of the way the NIV translates it. Apparently the word is shalom, one of the few Hebrew words that maybe some of us are familiar with. Peace, right? That's the Hebrew word. So the steward is saying to the brothers, shalom, it's okay, peace, it's good. Which the word comes up quite a few times in this passage, and so it looks bad for the brothers, but things are becoming more peaceful, and the word shalom comes up quite a few times. The steward took the men into Joseph's house, gave them water to wash their feet, prepared their gifts for Joseph's arrival. Joseph came home, they presented him the gifts, and they bowed down before him. Oh, there it is again. They bowed down before him to the ground, all 11 of them this time. He asked them how they were. That is how they translate shalom again. How are you? Shalom. And how is your aged father? The word again is shalom. About the old man. Is he still living? They replied, your servant, our father, is still alive and well. Shalom. Peace. He bowed low to pay him honor, and he saw his brother Benjamin, his own mother's son, and he asked, is this your youngest brother, the one you told me about? And he said, God be gracious to you, my son. Deeply moved at the sight of his brother, Joseph hurried out and looked for a place to weep. He went into his private room and wept there. The soft heart. After he had washed his face, he came out and, controlling himself, said, "Serve the food." They served him by himself, the brothers by themselves, the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves. The men had been seated before him in the order of their ages, from the firstborn to the youngest. And is this, how did that happen? They looked at each other in astonishment. Not only that, when portions were served to them from Joseph's table, Benjamin's portion was 5 times as much as anyone else's. And so, are you thinking what the brothers are thinking? Okay, yeah, he's the favorite son now, even to the Grand Vizier of Egypt. What's up with that? Figures, right? Of course. Well, Benjamin, yeah. Well, we don't hear of any discord or them being angry about it. They managed to have a good time. And Joseph gave these instructions to the steward. Fill the men's sack with as much food as they can carry. Put each man's silver in the mouth of his sack. Then put my cup, the silver one, in the mouth of the youngest one's sack, along with the silver for his grain. They left in the morning. Joseph said to his steward, "Go after those men at once, and when you catch up with them, say, 'Why have you repaid good with evil? Isn't this the cup my master drinks from and also uses for divination? This is a wicked thing you have done.'" So that's what happened. And they say, "Why does my lord say such thing? Far be it from your servants to do anything like that. We even brought back to you from the land of Canaan the silver we found inside the mouths of our sacks. So why would we steal silver or gold from your master's house? If any of your servants is found to have it, he will die, and the rest of us will become my lord's slaves." It doesn't really specify which of the brothers is saying it. I'm almost kind of guessing that it might have been Reuben. He's usually the first guy to pipe up and to maybe say stuff that maybe he shouldn't have. "If any of your servants is found to have it, he will die, and the rest of us will become my lord's slaves." Really? Because it turns out, wow, if that comes true, maybe you shouldn't have said that. But the steward kind of, he says, "Very well, let it be as you say," but he softens a little bit. "Whoever is found to have it will become my slave. The rest of you will be free from blame." Each of them quickly lowered his sack to the ground and opened it. Then the steward proceeded to search. He knew exactly where it was, but he's just going to draw it out a little bit, starting with the oldest, one by one. And finally, the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. That was just got to be excruciating. So they tore their clothes and they all loaded their donkeys and returned to the city. Another test for the brothers. Where are they at? Because in a way, they sort of had a way out. They said, "Oh yeah, Benjamin, I never liked him. He probably did steal it. He's spoiled. He's got no good character. He probably stole it. Yeah, Benjamin. Yeah. You go back and be that guy's slave because, yeah, you're guilty." But, right, they could have done that, but they've had a change of heart at some point, and they feel responsible, all of them, apparently. They all go back to the city. Joseph was still in the house when Judah and his brothers came in. It's interesting now, it would say it like that, Judah and his brothers. Judah's been sort of rising to be the one with some credibility among the brothers and more the leader. Interesting. They threw themselves to the ground before him. It's like the third time, at least. Joseph said to them, "What is this you have done? Don't you know that a man like me can find things out by divination?" And so now Judah represents. Judah says, "What can we say to my lord? What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. We are now my lord's slaves. We ourselves and the one who was found to have the cup." That was solidarity among the brothers. They're not hanging one out to dry. Joseph said, "Far be it from me to do such a thing. Only the man who was found to have the cup will become my slave. The rest of you go back to your father in peace." Shalom. So they have one more chance to hang out their brother Benjamin. They have one more chance to go. No. And who is it? Judah goes up to him and says, "Please, my lord, let your servant Speak a word to my lord. Do not be angry with your servant, though you are equal to Pharaoh himself. And so he explains how his father really cares about Benjamin. I can't do this to my father. I am personally responsible. So now if the boy, in verse 30, is not with us when I go back to your servant, my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, is he a boy, or is he like at least late 20s? Anyway, sometimes the youngest is always the baby. I don't know. But anyway, he was the youngest. He's the boy still at 20-something or 30-something. But anyway, if I do not bring him back, I told my father, guaranteed his safety. If I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, here's Judah's pitch. Please let your servant, me, remain here as my lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come upon my father. And so the testing is complete, and the brothers rise to the occasion. Judah represents, and he puts himself out personally responsible. What else? It's as good as he can do, and it's good enough for Joseph. In chapter 45, Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept once again. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" And they're looking at him like deers in the headlight. And who knows what else. His brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. You got the Grand Vizier of Egypt. Who knows what he looked like? He looked like an Egyptian. He probably had all the whatever headgear and the make. I don't know. He did not look like a Hebrew Canaanite guy, right? So this Grand Vizier is like, "I am your brother." And really, "Come closer. Come close to me." When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt." And I guess they're kind of warming up to the fact eventually. "And now, do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." He lets them off the hook for selling them. And he says, "It's God that sent me. For 2 years now there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will not be plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh," which is a little bit of a weird phrase, but in terms of kind of the title Grand Vizier, I guess, he's kind of father to Pharaoh in a way, function-wise. "Lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt, now hurry back to my father and say to him, 'This is what your son Joseph says, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, don't delay.'" Joseph credits God. He believes that God has orchestrated the whole thing. Is he right? We believe that he is right. God did orchestrate it. God had promised Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. God told Abraham many years ago, "You're going to be in Egypt." He is making it happen. Joseph not only tells his dreams, which is the truth of what's going to happen when he's 17 years old, not only he interprets dreams, but he sees the providing hand of God in what's happening, that ultimately God is in control. And so God uses Joseph to reconcile his brothers, to help his brothers understand that God is providing for them. So he puts them through this. Now they're reconciled. There was a bit of a process to that in order for them to be reconciled, and now they can be happy together. He threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept, And Benjamin embraced him, weeping, and he kissed all his brothers and wept over them, hugs and kisses all around. Afterward, his brothers talked with him, and it's good, pretty much. Yeah, let's do it. Pharaoh says, yeah, come on down. Come on down, bring your family. Bring them all. It's fantastic. Bring your family, and we'll take care of them. And yeah, they go back. Joseph gave them carts, as Pharaoh had commanded, and he also gave them provisions for their journey. Verse 22, to each of them he gave new clothing, but to Benjamin, he's just got to do it, doesn't he? He gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 sets of clothes. Oh, you don't mind if I do a little extra for Benjamin, do you hear? You don't mind that? Well, we'll see. Yeah, I guess it's okay. It's okay now. It's okay. And sent the 10 donkeys. Verse 24, then he sent his brothers away, and as they were leaving, he said to them, don't quarrel on the way. Were they likely to quarrel? It's real happiness. Everybody's happy now. The story ends real happy, but they're going to Jacob, and they're saying, Joseph's alive, and Jacob's going to say, how's that work? And maybe they'll have to tell his father the truth, and maybe Reuben will pipe up and say, well, I didn't go along with that at the beginning, and there's going to, who knows what Joseph was anticipating, what kind of quarreling is going on. What are we going to tell our dad about this whole thing? We've got to figure it out. Anyway, don't quarrel. So they went down, told Jacob, Joseph is still alive. In fact, he is ruler of all Egypt. Jacob was stunned, of course. He did not believe them, but when they told him everything Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the carts Joseph had sent to carry him back, the spirit of their father revived. And Israel said, I am convinced my son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. And so that's what happens. This is kind of a grand, a happy ending to the story of Joseph. And wow, what do we learn? We learn that God saves his people. God saves his people then and now. Through a process, his people, just like the brothers of Joseph, have to go through a bit of a process. Number one, God is concerned about their and our conscience. Like Joseph was concerned about his brother's conscience, do they even have one? God is even more concerned about our conscience, because we are supposed to have a conscience to know if we've offended God, kind of like Joseph's brothers offended Joseph, did something wrong. So, do we have a conscience? If we're guilty, do we feel guilty? Because if we are guilty of something wrong, we should feel guilty. I don't know if anyone here has felt guilt over doing something wrong. Some people think that just the feeling of guilt is bad, so don't feel guilty regardless. But if you are guilty, you should feel guilty. And when I remember feeling guilty, doing things wrong, I still do once in a while. Number two, not only does God want us to have a conscience, God wants us to take responsibility for our sin, just like Joseph was interested in knowing if his brothers took responsibility for their sin. They're taking responsibility, and there's consequences. Like Paul says, the wages of sin is death. There's consequences for us today of sin. And to put it in those terms, I write checks sometimes in my job for people to get paid. And in the memo, I put wages. Imagine a check, and instead of money, it's death. And your name's on it. The wages of sin is death. Oh, you're too kind. Oh, that's yours. Death. Your name's on it. It's signed. That's what you're getting paid for. You're not getting paid in money. You're getting paid in death. Don't be shy. Take it. You've earned it. The wages of sin is death. God wants us to take responsibility for our sin. Each of us, have we sinned? Maybe not murder or slave trading. I know I have. Even lying to my mom when I was a kid, and she found out, and I paid at that time, but I knew I was sinning. I knew I was doing something wrong. I knew I mistreated my little brother a little bit. I was wrong. I knew I was a sinner, and so I found out, yes, the wages of sin is death. I'm responsible. God wants us to take responsibility for our sin. Number three, God has provided forgiveness, and it's through Christ As Ephesians says, in him, Jesus, we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins. Joseph wanted to forgive his brothers. God forgives us on the basis of Christ's blood. As Hebrews says, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. That's the basis that God has provided forgiveness for us. Number four, God has provided salvation. Use the same phrase as Joseph did, salvation by a great deliverance. God has provided salvation for us. It's a spiritual salvation. It's not so much a salvation from starving of a famine. It's a spiritual salvation where he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness, Colossians says, and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves. He's rescued us. It's a rescue mission. God has delivered, rescued us. You turned from God to God, from idols, Paul tells the Thessalonians, to serve the living and true God and to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, who rescues us from the coming wrath. So we need to be rescued too. So God saves his people then and now. That's what we learn, I believe, today. Yeah, it's a neat story. It's a fantastic story. But God orchestrates, God provided, he preserved, he saved the people of Israel. He fulfilled his promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And we're his people too. Not in the same way, but we still have to go through a process, each of us, to be reconciled, to be saved. And it ends up probably for us even way better than it ended up for Joseph and his brothers, because God saves us. Let's close in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for the story of Joseph and the truth that you took care of the people of Israel, Jacob, his family, even the ones that were not well behaved. And we thank you for providing us forgiveness and salvation, even though we didn't deserve it. We thank you for reconciling us for the forgiveness that is in Christ for each of us. And may we have a fresh understanding of that. May we realize what you have done for us. We realize how you have saved us and rescued us through Christ. And the truth of that, we do thank you for your word. Ask your blessing on us now, in Jesus' name.